Blog Talk Radio.
Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
The Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio comes to you to connect politics and finance, humanity and world peace, and the arts in a way that encourages all to think for themselves so the best political and life choices are made by all. With artistic overtones, The Reasonable Voice is an advocate for a peaceful and prosperous world filled with creativity and political peaceful unity. My guest today is one I've been really looking forward to talking to again. It's Jackie Martin. Jackie Martin does many things, but in our community and for our community in Charlottesville and Albemarle County, etc. But today I wanted to have a conversation with her about the history of the community surrounding the Jefferson School City Center where Jackie now works. First of all, hello Jackie, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Marcello?
I'm terrific, thank you. I'm just did that introduction make sense and cover enough for our purposes today?
Absolutely. I don't think you mentioned though that I did grow up in this neighborhood too, and I do want to talk some about that.
Well, that's exactly why we're having this conversation today. I'm so glad you're on the show. Well, speaking of growing up in this neighborhood, let's name the neighborhood, first of all. It's Star Hill?
Right. I work right now in the Jefferson School City Center, which is located in the Star Hill neighborhood. My grandparents live not in Star Hill, but very close on 9th Street Northwest, and so I spent a lot of time in that area, and I grew up on Hartman's Mill Road, which is right off of Ridge Street in Charlottesville.
Wow. There's a lot of history. I think we all know. I mean, you know, we know the big stories. Long before I lived in Charlottesville, I would visit all the major well-known institutions, UVA, Monticello, Montpelier, missing one, I know. I can't think of the other one. It's out there, but someone will call in. But I didn't know anything, I confess, about the Jefferson School, and I was here once on a story, and someone said, well, why don't we meet at the Jefferson School, because that's a very historical place, and they were giving me an address and everything, and I said, can you describe, I've been down East Main, and I don't know what you're talking about, and they said, well, it's a big red brick building set off the road a bit, and now that must have been, I'd say, 3 years ago, and
okay.
I don't know what it was, but I saw that building, and I saw the name on it, and I saw the condition it was in, and that started my, and it's more than curiosity, I guess my love and need to know about that school and that that community. And since then, as you know, a lot has developed, but we'll get into that. I'll let you talk a bit. I know neither of us goes back to 1927, nor can we remember really 1958, but the Jefferson School, as I understand, was built in 1927, although there are some stages of growth prior to that, I understand, to go back to the last century. But in 1958, things were happening in Virginia as they were in the country with racial tensions and civil rights and riots and whatever. So but what I'm really interested, rather than just reviewing what some of us may or may not know historically, I want you and your family's story, regardless of how much or how little you may know personally, but tell us what you do know. I mean, Vinegar Hill is something I have heard about a lot, and the whole urban renewal is what they called it in the 1960s. Can we start there and then just work from...
I can tell you what I know, and I think what is really interesting about what I know is that I don't know a lot about the racial tension that was going on in Charlottesville. I was born in 1961, and what I remember about Vinegar Hill is being in Mr. Engine's store.
Uh-huh.
I have fond memories of that store, and it was in the Vinegar Hill neighborhood. Now, you know, it became part of the urban renewal and was torn down, but that I don't remember. I don't remember my parents ever talking about the store after that. My memories about Jefferson go back to being a sixth grader. And I did go to sixth grade at Jefferson, but by that time schools were integrated, and I was just very grateful. I was happy because my father was principal at Jefferson the year before I was scheduled to go there, and I was just horrified. I mean, he's a wonderful dad, but I definitely did not want to have him as my principal. He moved to another school when I came to Jefferson. I think he moved to Walker. And so, you know, I kind of, you know, I do have some memories that go back to second grade that have to do with race. One thing I have to tell you about that really stands out, and my mother was a teacher at Clark Elementary School, and I think I was in the second grade when this happened. And I was at Clark, and a student there commented that I must live in a shack or something like that. And I didn't know why she said that, but I was very upset about it. So it became a huge deal. They called my mother down and explained to this little girl that both of my parents were educators. I didn't live in a shack. It wasn't until years later that I realized she thought that because I was black.
Oh, my God.
Now, by the time I got to Jefferson, there were black and white students, and I don't remember any tension at Jefferson. You know, I find this to be interesting. I have learned more about massive resistance in the last 10 years than I ever knew growing up here in this area. It was never something that was talked about in school, you know, any government history class. Never covered that, and I went to Charlottesville Public Schools and later to Albemarle and graduated from Western.
You know, it is true that one who looks for history, like complete history that includes all the colors of the rainbow, that it just wasn't kept, and it certainly wasn't taught. I've often said, and perhaps even on this show, when I've talked to people, that I'm certainly no historian, but I have taught history, and I really resented long after I left the classroom as a teacher, guest teacher and guest artist and substitute teacher, all of that sort of thing. When I realized the more I read and the longer I lived, I realized I had been teaching an incomplete story. And I found that, and still do find that, very disconcerting. And I think it's part of what drives me when I find out a piece of history. I mean, Charlottesville and Virginia too, for that matter, full of history. But if you don't get the whole story, then you're missing. Do you think, I don't want to leave this, but do you think that the, for a moment, just because we have a little time, the attempts of the Charlottesville, Maurice Jones, I'm forgetting, a city manager Maurice Jones, and his efforts to have a human rights commission and a dialogue on race, is this a step in the right direction? We can't go back, but at least we can educate. What do you know of these two groups, organizations he seems to have sort of brought to the city council? I don't know how open the city council is to it, but what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, my personal opinion is that the Human Rights Commission is something that we need in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And the dialogue on race, and I have to tell you, I have not participated in that, but I think any time when you bring people together to talk about a topic like race, that's hard to talk about.
Yes.
And we avoid talking about it. It's good. It can't be anything but good for our community.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what we're talking about today. I know I have other friends in the community who, it seems to be extremes. I have friends who, like Andrea Douglas, who's been on the show, who is a wealth of information and is more than willing to talk about issues. But I know many others who will talk to me privately, but they won't come on the show because they, as you just said, they don't want to talk about it. I have a very dear friend whose family has been documented as descendants of Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson, and she will talk to me about this, and I've tried to get her, you know, to come on the show, and she says no, I'll tell you, and she said, and I'm going to say what she said because I get it. She said, I don't think that's something I'm not proud of it. It's not something I want to brag about. It's something that happened, but it's not necessarily something I want to talk about. And of course, I respect that's her opinion.
And, you know, I have lately, and I need to ask my parents, I've often thought about why they didn't talk to us about things like massive resistance and what happened to Vinegar Hill, all of that. And what I've decided for myself, you know, both of my parents raised me to be very proud of my race and background, and particularly my dad. And I think it was a source of shame, maybe. He didn't want us to know how things used to be.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think maybe he was in some way shameful of what went on here in Charlottesville. So, again, you ask me how I feel about the dialogue on race, and I think it's a positive thing for our community, because whatever background you come from, we need to feel free to talk about and express our opinion on things that are sometimes uncomfortable for us to do so.
You know, we're saying a few phrases that maybe not everyone, after all, Blog Talk Radio reaches the world, not everyone will know, so maybe we need to define. What is massive resistance?
Well, massive resistance, and again, I told you I'm just learning about this, but when schools were ordered to integrate, schools here in our area decided to close instead of allowing that to happen, and that's what is called massive resistance.
Yeah, so people understand, it was the governor of Virginia who responded to federal orders to integrate by saying he was going to close the schools or he wasn't going to let it happen. But he actually closed some Virginia schools, did he not?
Yes, some schools were closed. I'm not sure how long, but yes, they were closed.
Instead of integrating. But at the same time, massive resistance was Are you saying there's another wrinkle in that, other than what I just said? I just want to understand what you told us.
Oh no, I think you have summed it up well.
Okay, so we were saying the same thing. I just wanted to make certain I didn't misunderstand you. Okay, because I then back to Vinegar Hill. Vinegar Hill is, as I started to say earlier, I've heard of Vinegar Hill. I knew something of Vinegar Hill because of what happened to it. And so that everybody knows, in the 1960s, we're saying the nice euphemism, urban renewal. But what really happened, and I won't conjecture on the racial reasons. I won't. But I'll just give the facts. What happened is that a neighborhood, a whole community that was predominantly, if not exclusively, predominantly a black neighborhood of that is residentially and businesses, one of which you were just discussing earlier, they just simply were razed. They were disappeared. And it happened because for me, knowing that it happened in the 1960s, when so much other was going on, both positive and very negative, that was racially oriented and a fight for and against civil rights, one wonders about the timing. I'm going to take a short break here. I'm going to be right back. Stay with us. Don't go away. This conversation will continue with Jackie Martin about the history of a very focused history on the untold story, for the most part, in downtown and central, not just central Virginia, but central Charlottesville. We'll be right back. Don't go away.
Every black person subscribes to the theory of Machiavelli. It's better to be feared than loved. Black people know for a fact they will never deserve the love of white people, so they command their fear. Love is a choice, but fear is mandatory. I can't make you love me, but I can make you fear me. One is unrequited and one is required. White people can reject me with their open arm hugs, but white people cannot avoid the open fire of thugs. If you will not feel me and pull me in close, chest to chest, you will feel the cold steel and hot lead penetrating your chest. Penetration is intimacy. A gun pointed to your chest, putting a hole in it. Injury is intimacy. Black men will become inmates just to become intimate. Maximum security is security. Prison, the only way to feel like a person. Jail forces white people to keep us in America. Diamonds are imported from Africa, and never the other way around.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. That was a spoken word from our poet in residence, Mr. Bernard Hankins. And now I'm back with my guest, Jackie Martin, whose family, father, mother, aunt, and herself, of course, and now moving on to her son's generation, have been very involved in the educational system in Central Virginia, Central Charlottesville, Albemarle County, Vinegar Hill, Star Hill. That's the area we're focusing on, but we're focusing on really the personal history of this family. Jackie, tell me what, I know you're involved with the new, very new, restored and renovated Jefferson School City Center, but can you tell me also what about your son's educational experiences in this area? How do they differ from yours?
Oh, okay. Gladly. My son is 31 now, and he did grow up in this area. He attended county schools, but you know, I would like to share with your audience some of his experiences growing up here with the school system. And there are a couple in particular that stand out to me that are race related. First time in second grade, I'll never forget this. You know, my son, I always raised him to question people, or I thought I did, and ask a lot of questions. And he came home from second grade very proud of himself, and wanting to share with me what he learned that day. And he told me that he learned in school that Thomas Jefferson was nice to his slaves. Well, I immediately became very upset hearing this, and I tried to talk to him about how you can't both hold someone in servitude and consider yourself nice to them.
Yes.
And he argued with me. I mean, he's a second grader at this
point.
He argued with me that that was what he'd been taught. So next day at school, I'm at the door of the school waiting to talk to them about this. And what I came to find out is that that is what some educators were teaching our children. It wasn't an isolated case.
Oh, I know.
They were being taught that Thomas Jefferson was nice to his slaves.
Yes.
And so that is an incident my son and I laugh about today. And another thing, you know, I want to share, and this isn't specifically, I don't think, about race. And I'll say to you, Marcello, I think that's one of the reasons it's hard to talk about race in Charlottesville, and that's because I've lived in the South, and in the South, if they didn't like you because you were a different race, they didn't hesitate to tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Charlottesville, what I feel is that you never know for sure if it's about race. You may think it is.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I'm sure it is, and sometimes it isn't, but people aren't so forthright to express that to you. But as a middle school student, my son Jonathan was excellent in math, and so when he was going on to high school, I looked for his teacher to give him a recommendation to an advanced math class in high school.
Mm.
And that didn't happen, and so I went to her and asked why not. He had excellent grades, and she said to me that she felt he wasn't organized enough to be successful in high school at math.
Wow.
Well, he's still not organized, Marcello, but my son has a PhD at this point, and I say that only because I think a lot of times, particularly African American parents, don't feel empowered to go to the school.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel fortunate because, you know, again, both of my parents were educators.
Mm-hmm.
And the next, you know, I was right there at the school to find out why and to insist that he was allowed to take an advanced placement math class. That one thing, and I'm not patting myself on the back, would, had he not gotten in that class, it could have changed his entire path.
Of course, absolutely.
And, yeah, and so I just mention that only to say any parent of any color, but I think particularly in some cases, African Americans don't feel that we have that right to question schools as maybe we should mm-hmm. for our kids.
Well, I agree with you on both points, but regardless of the color of one's skin, having been in not really a career classroom teacher by any means, but I have from time to time in my career been a teacher in professional schools and in public schools. You know, professional schools, I mean, with adults in New York as opposed to public schools in Maryland and Virginia. But I always made it clear to the administration that my classroom was always open. And that didn't just mean for parents to come and have a conference with me, which, of course, they could, but they could come into my class anytime and visit and sit in the class and watch what we were doing. Now,
wow.
admittedly, I wasn't teaching math. I was directing plays or teaching theater history or video or news broadcast. But still, I wanted the parents to feel they could be a part of the class. They could come in. I mean, they couldn't interrupt the class, but they certainly could come in and watch, observe. And so I gave them the answer. You know, the one at the dinner table, what did you do at school today? Well, they got to see the answer, so they didn't have to ask. You know, going back, I want to mention, I do want to talk about your dad for a bit, but
okay.
Not quite yet. I had the great pleasure of meeting him recently. But let's talk about the churches in Star Hill. I know that faith has been a big part of this community. Well, the Jefferson School City Center is an act of faith. Talk about a leap of faith several times, and by the larger community. Although, you know, once the checks are written and renovations and restorations were made, and they're beautiful, still, it was the few who stayed to actually run what's happening there, and the tenants who are there, and all that wonderful synergy that they have. But for a moment, the area is rife with churches. I mean, Charlottesville is known for having so many restaurants, you know, almost rivaling New York. But it's the number of churches is also impressive. Can you speak to any of that?
There are many, and you know, as you were talking, I'm making a list of those that I know, and I'm bound to leave some out. But really close to Jefferson, you have Ebenezer Baptist Church, you have First Baptist Church, there's Trinity Church, and Mount Zion First African Baptist Church isn't too terribly far away. And so, yeah, churches have always been very important in this community, and there are many in this area.
I think that's not an insignificant thing. I don't want to go off on a tangent on what that may mean, but it certainly means the people in this community we know have been through a lot together. There has been an evolution. There has been a revolution, and to have so many places of worship, I think, speaks to, at least in part, how they saw their way through it all. Is that too?
Oh, I absolutely agree with you.
Okay, let me talk about your dad for a moment. I had the great pleasure. I am involved in the video production for the second time. In 2011, I was involved in a video production or documentary, if you will, about the Jefferson School before the ground was broken, even. And going there and interviewing Andrea Douglas and others involved in the project when it was 30 degrees inside, because there was no heat on, that was an experience to see that that place standing as a shell of its former self, and to see the vision of the people involved who said, we're not just going to renovate, we're going to restore. And of course now, 2 years later, as you know, they have, and the beauty of it, I believe, is that it marries the past and the present as it moves into the future. I mean, physically, I know from 2011 only, from videoing there, that some of what's been retained, including the original chairs from the school auditorium that line the hallways, and some in the first two rows are still there in the theater space itself, and the door frames and window frames, and then married to this state-of-the-art institution. This building has so much in itself. So, in any case, in the course of directing this video, I met your father.
Okay.
And I have to tell you, I don't know, we were working on something else when he arrived at the theater, and I think he was going to the main office to see where he was supposed to go, probably. But I knew who he was. That's what I loved. I'd never met him. I'd never heard his voice, seen his face, a photograph, nothing. But when he walked into the room, not that he tried to take over the room, far from it. He's a very a humble person, clear, but he's one of those people, you know, like my family used to say, the boss is the one who doesn't have to carry the gun. I'll say no more on that. But, you know, he came in with a reverence. That's the word I'm looking for. That immediately drew my attention. And I went over and you know, asked if he was who I thought he was. And he said yes. And I brought him up on the stage, asked him, you know, we set it up so we could have an interview and find out from him. As you say, he was principal, he was administrator, he was a teacher, he told me he was a student there.
He was. And it's funny, Marcello, I've worked here briefly when the preschool program was here at Jefferson, and in the office I found some of his school records.
Wow.
Yeah, so he did go to school here. He taught here. He was principal here. So he does have that history, and I can't tell you how proud he is of the restoration here at Jefferson, and how proud I am too. It's amazing to come in here and see what they've done with the building. You know, the subway tile that I very much, or that's what I call it.
Yes.
I don't know if that's the official name.
But I know what you mean.
Back up the auditorium, my sixth grade classroom was behind the stage. And it looked to me just like I remember it looking back then. And so they've done an amazing job. And yeah, to, you know, for my dad to come back in here now and volunteer in the Heritage Center, and not just my dad, but gosh, I don't know what might have happened to this building had it not been for such a large group of the alumni that spoke
yes.
up for the restoration. And it took years, but they've done such a beautiful job, and it's hear people come in and point out where their classrooms
yes.
were and who taught in what area. There's a lot of pride associated with the building.
It really is, and I could certainly see it in his face and hear it in his voice, but I know what you mean, and as I said, my first introduction to the interior was 2011, and I see the amazing change. Imagine your father and you and your mother, and you say your mother taught there too?
My mother did teach here. Yeah.
Wow. Well, it was a pleasure to, of course, talk to you as well in this video. But your dad, he just brought a perspective that when you are from a totally different world and you're just walking into this piece of gigantic, important history, and you ask a question, and you think. I mean, I don't know if I consciously thought this, but you think you've asked an intelligent, comprehensive question. And then this man answers it, but he answers it with the simplicity of describing what it was like, and yet you could hear all the pride and joy from what it's become. One of his answers I will never forget, and it is in the video. He said, well, you know, a lot of the places still look like they looked when I was here, except now we have a lot of improvements like heat and air conditioning and an elevator.
Wow.
And you know, when you hear that, you might go, you might chuckle, you might. But I, being there, and I hope we've captured it on the video, to me it was those simple things that we now so take for granted
right.
were not there, and he noticed and appreciated, and it was just a real pleasure to have that time with him. Tell me, we're going to have to go pretty soon. I hope I haven't done most of the talking. It's just that everything, it's just you and your family and all those people, you know, as you say, who came together and made this happen. The architects, the city, Deborah, I'm sorry, I can't remember her husband or her last name, but Deborah.
Oh, Bert.
Yes. So many people, and now the tenants that are there working together, all nonprofits, like 10 in the building. Yes.
Oh, absolutely. And we do work together. We meet regularly and talk about how we can collaborate, and so that's been great, and we have lots of partnerships going on in the building.
Give us a list, if you can, of some of the people who are there. You don't have to get them all, and maybe I can fill
okay.
in.
Martha Jefferson Starhill Health Center is here, focused on childhood obesity, literacy volunteers, Common Ground Healing Arts. JABA has both their Mary Williams Senior Center here and a cafe on the first floor. The YMCA Child Care Center is here, and of course Carver Recreation is an anchor tenant, as well as the African American Heritage Center. And I think that's everyone. Literacy Volunteers,
yes.
And Common Ground Healing Arts,
yes.
I mentioned that.
Oh, did you? Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. It's just a remarkable place. And
I'm missing the Women's Initiative.
Right. That's what it is.
Okay.
But they're all there, all working together, and I think it is a testimony of the people. I think the building has its history, but its history really is the people who have gone through it, the people who have made their contribution to it and received an education and given an education in that building. In the first video, I met some of those students that you were talking about who walked into, I mean, the new theater space has much of the original floor. It's just, we could go on and on. Unfortunately, we don't have time to go on and on, but I so appreciate your being on the show today, Jackie.
Thank you very much. And you know, Marcello, I'm going to have to say quickly that Piedmont Virginia Community College has some classes going on in the building as well.
That's right.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you so much for the invitation.
All right, then. And it has been so informative. I hope everybody out there will come to Charlottesville now for an additional historical reason. And all of us who live in Charlottesville, Albemarle County, Nelson, the four counties, you need to come see what is there. The entire Jefferson School City Center is now abuzz with services from 10 different nonprofit organizations. Even the JABA, for instance, all the things that you've mentioned, and health services and so forth. You need to go and at least see, have lunch at the Vinegar Hill Cafe, and walk around and see what there is to offer right in downtown Charlottesville, which we've learned from Jackie today has seen a lot of history. This is the Reasonable Voices. In the studio with me today are technical support, creative catalyst, and spoken word poet, Mr. Bernard Hankins, with Michelle Opperman and Danielle Garner, the literary duo and philosophical minds who created O.G. Rose. We're going to say goodbye to our guest, Jackie Martin, but you stay with us because we'll be back with our panel to discuss.
Black men steal jewelry boxes to feel like priceless treasures in a jewelry box. Jail cells house and enclose rare stones. Hope diamonds in the rough. Rough necks want to feel valuable like the gold rope chains they wear around their necks. Iron bars are really gold bars because what you love, you protect. Guard it with your life like a husband does a wife to fight off a burglar stealing your best silverware in the night. Black men wear rare silver to feel like silverware. Shiny and polished to see their own reflection. Hold you at knife point just to be able to hold you. Shoot you at point blank just to know you aren't pointing blanks in love with tips that are hollow. Shoplifts on the cop's shift, hoping the cop will stop him. Black people actually want to be followed. Enter juvenile detention centers to be the center of attention. Thug juice, drug use, dope in hopes of getting an intervention. Throw their guns in the air and wave them like they just don't care, so someone will throw their arms around them and hug them because they're sure white people just don't care. Thugs are one letter removed from hugs.
Welcome back. The Reasonable Voices in the studio with me today are our technical staff, creative catalyst, and spoken word poet, Mr. Bernard Hankins, with Michelle Oppelman and Daniel Garner, the literary duo and philosophical minds who created O.G. Rose. And I'm your host, Marcello Rolando. We talk about a lot of things in our panel discussions. Sometimes we talk about the people who are our guests, and sometimes we get a little far afield, but we come back. I'm just curious. I've been asked many times, especially recently. It's not too long ago that the word celebrate is not the word, but observed the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John Kennedy as opposed to celebrating his life. And I'm asked often, because I was alive when that happened, what was that like? And I always want to ask people, you know, more to the point now, 50 plus years after, what is it like for you who were not alive? And since I've got three people in the room who weren't, I'm pretty certain of that. You tell me. Who wants to go first? Michelle.
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting, you know, you talked about us getting, you know, far stretched from our topics, but you know, we had guests who were in showbiz and have also been in the arts. And I think, honestly, JFK, for somebody who didn't live his assassination or through his presidency, I know him more as a, you know, pop culture icon,
sure.
You know, than as a president. And, you know, that other person who comes up to the two people who come to the top of my head who have been assassinated would be John Lennon, you know, Abraham Lincoln, who's another president.
Yes.
But so I think that factor for me to experience, you know, there's such a distance from that even the idea of it happening, that really I can only see it through the lens of a, you know, far and fading tale.
Sure.
And also the fact that he himself was, he was an actor. I mean, wasn't he, in terms of being in pop culture, John F. Kennedy was a very renowned, you know, figure, and like Daniel mentioned, one of the first people to be on TV as a president. So that's also has to do with our discussion on media. But
first presidential debates to air on TV.
Next,
yes.
Kennedy.
Well, it's funny you use the word lens, because I'm going to perform this poem tomorrow at this event, and it deals a lot with the image and language of camera. And one of my favorite topics is this idea of how when you're far away from something, it seems so big. Like, we look at Hitler and we're like, how could you not see, you know, all the concentration camps and what Hitler was doing?
Mm-hmm.
But when you're in the middle of it, in the thick of it, you don't think that way. Just like right now, there's stuff happening around us that people are going to look at us and be like, how could you all not see this?
Right.
So that's how I apply it to Kennedy, because to me, the assassination has become much more like, not so much, sort of like Michelle was saying, not so much like pop.
Yeah.
But it's become larger than life. Like,
right.
I can't see Kennedy without thinking about the assassination.
Yeah.
It's not just, oh, President Kennedy. It's like, and the Cadillac and, you know, the guy from the book depository, and it's such a scandal, and was it a cover-up, and was it a, you know, conspiracy? So to me, it's hard to see him as anything else other than a larger-than-life story.
It'd be interesting to know what Kennedy was like before the assassination, because then after it occurs, there's no way to know of him other than in the context of he was assassinated. Same could be said of Martin Luther King, Lenin, Abraham Lincoln, etc., etc. And I always think that's very interesting, because there's a totally different experience one has of a president or a person before they're assassinated than after they're assassinated. Kennedy, as I understand him, was a rather extraordinary president. I mean, we have the Camelot. I mean, his entire family was... He seems to have been someone who gave the country this sort of feel of an almost image, an ideal of this is like the, as far as I understand, sort of the perfect family in a sense. I know that his wife would have television broadcasts of walking almost the country across, you know, through the White House to see the home and to see the house. And I suppose that then was the first president to ever do that, to make the American people feel as if they're in the White House or part of the White House. And then to have that, and on that, the assassination, that seems like it would be doubly devastating in a way. And there's almost a question of, Was he, why did the assassination happen? Why did he do it? Maybe there's a relation there. Maybe the pressure of being so in the White House, part of the president's life, fed it. It's hard to say.
I'm glad to hear you mention the word Camelot, because in the recent overkill, pardon, that was not intended as a pun, of the media with, you know, there are more than 100,000 books about Kennedy, John Kennedy in particular. But Camelot, I will say, I remember quite vividly as a child when this happened and what had happened, how I felt and how the grown-ups were behaving around me, etc. And as it turned out this year, the dates were on the exact days again. It was Friday the 22nd in 63, and it was Friday through the 25th this year in 2013. So it's especially eerie. But I want to get back to Camelot because recently David Brooks of the New York Times said that Camelot was a terrible thing, and this is why. Are we ready? Because President Kennedy convinced Americans, all of America, that by working together, an American government could, and with the people, because of course his famous quote, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country, is that we could do anything we wanted to do, and that somehow that was a very bad negative thing because we can't. And not too long ago we had a panel discussion about the half full and the half empty glass. What's your take on that?
Well, David Brooks, he wrote Bobo's in Paradise. Yes, he wrote Bobo's in Paradise. He also wrote The Social Animal. And I suppose he's coming at it from a perspective of people think too highly of themselves. He kind of talks about the Starbucks latte sort of generation and how that leads to a spoiled age. I wouldn't say that Kennedy necessarily calls that. I think people want that. Rather, you can't really blame a president, perhaps. I mean, that's interesting. Since I really was not alive during Camelot, I would not know if that had the effect on the society. Marshall,
well,
did it?
Yeah, I have to tell you, there was no Camelot. Nobody called it Camelot, except Jackie Kennedy, in passing because he happened to like the song. But that was after his death. Camelot, really, in my opinion, was not because Jackie Kennedy mentioned although it's certainly believed that she was smart enough, she had a sense of history and his legacy, that she did choose the word carefully to give it a label because Americans respond to labels. But the reality is the real Camelot existed before John Kennedy's assassination. He had won by the smallest majority ever Nixon.
Right.
The country was divided, and by the time he gave his inaugural address, we were all, wow, gee, gosh, we were taken because of the very thing that I find so surprising, even for David Brooks, that he's accusing him of doing as a negative thing. No, it was inspiring. Mm. We can do good things. After all, this is the guy who created the Peace Corps, which wasn't about making a lot of money, but it certainly was about serving humankind.
Well, something I haven't talked about yet, which is race, which I think is something to bring in, which is interesting.
Yes, yes.
I'm always reminded of the scene in Malcolm X with, you know, the Spike Lee movie.
Yes,
where Malcolm X comes out and says, well, the chickens have come home to roost and you all got what you deserve. But then Elijah Muhammad takes him aside and is like, I told nobody to talk about this man. The nation loved this man.
Yes.
I was so intrigued that even a radical, like, we are pro-black and we don't care what the white man thinks, even he was like, keep your mouth shut because you don't want to rock the bus. I found it fascinating that Kennedy had even that kind of respect about himself, that something like the Nation of Islam was like, we kind of know a certain boundary which we need to engage in a certain way.
You know, and he didn't arrive in the White House as a civil rights liberal. He had to grow into that, but so did the country. And I remember, as I remember the first time I really knew about Dr. Martin Luther King, I came home and there he was on the television doing the I Have a Dream speech, and I couldn't even take off my jacket from school. I was riveted to the spot. Mm-hmm. So these men of that time, like the leaders of the 40s, good and bad, they didn't start out knowing that they were going to have such an impact on the world. But he did. Ultimately, he realized, I mean, there was a great pragmatism. As Bernard brings up race, the South was locked dead set against anyway that Kennedy was going to be reelected, no matter what he did. And much of what Johnson did after is because people felt guilty, oh my God, we should have done this, you know, now, while he was alive.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, didn't Kennedy, two points, like Kennedy have a lot of sicknesses, back problems, and things? So I think, I don't believe he made that public. So there's kind of an element of the American spirit in that overcoming. Oh, yeah. And two, I think, you know, when it comes to what I guess Brooks is saying on the idea that of almost the question of American exceptionalism, this idea we do it. Well, the understanding of the word exceptional does not necessarily mean one is better. It's mm-hmm. different.
Yeah.
And the real understanding of American exceptionalism is that America is different. Mm-hmm. But that is a responsibility, because if you're different, that doesn't necessarily mean you're better. Yes. That means you might have more stakes. You know, you're going to go a different road than other nations, that being liberty, being mm-hmm. the idea. And I think in Kennedy, at least, you have this idea of American exceptionalism being asked not what your country can do for you, but what can you do for your country, and it'd be good to restore that sense of exceptional.
Yes. Yes. Excellent. Michelle, anything else to close us out?
Oh, me. I just want to hear your. I want to just ask you a billion questions, my child. since you were, you know, around and able to perceive and have a sense of what his assassination really meant. I'm just curious. You said the adults, how they were acting around you.
Oh, yes. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I'm not begging off that question. We will do it another time, but we're a little too close for me to start on that, except I will say once a young lady was my age when he was assassinated, was a student, and asked me what it was like, and I'll try and share that some other time. But we're out of time today. The Reasonable Voices in the studio with me today are technical support and creative catalyst and spoken word poet Mr. Bernard Hankins, with Michelle Opperman and David L. Garner, the literary duo and philosophical minds who created O.G. Rose. Thank you for joining us today and every Friday and recommending us to your friends. I am the Reasonable Voice, Marcello Rolando, hoping you will become one of the Reasonable Voices heard round the world.